On the program today, the macro view as always, oil today, trade today, the big picture things, and a micro business trying to get by. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizal. It is Monday today. This one is the 8th of March. Good, as always, to have you along, everybody. It's a rule, I think, of the news planning business that as soon as you decide to do a story on rising oil prices, crude prices are going to go down. And so they did today. It was a little bit of a roller coaster. We'll start by stipulating that an attack on Saudi oil facilities was the proximate cause of prices spiking higher this morning, $70 a barrel, before they settled lower on the day. But look, there was a point in this pandemic when crude prices were negative, if you remember that. Back in April, you would have had to pay to take delivery. So the current state of affairs, that ain't so bad. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman gets us going.
Get ready for it. Here's what's happened to the global oil market in the last 12 months in Trader Argo.
We moved from what is called contango to backwardation, a backwardated market.
That's energy consultant Stephen Shork. And to explain in regular people terms, the contango market happened when crude oil demand and prices plummeted after the pandemic hit. Then in the fall, the global economy came out of COVID hibernation and needed more oil and gas.
Demand now is beginning to outstrip supply. There's a lot of optimism about a vaccine. The economies around the globe opening up.
Which has driven prices up. Alex Ramos-Payon at Rystad Energy says that's good news for shale oil producers in the Permian Basin of Texas and New Mexico.
One of the most prolific and one of the most affordable sources of oil nowadays globally. So with all of the efficiencies that we've seen in drilling, in fracking, essentially all areas of the Permian are commercial and very profitable at $60.
But more oil pumping profitably out of the ground doesn't necessarily mean another boom time in rig workers' jobs and pay. That's because there's been massive consolidation, accelerated by the pandemic, says analyst Michael Orlando at Econ One Research.
We saw a record number of bankruptcies in the oil and gas sector in 2020, and we were going to see a contraction in employment in the industry, cost reduction in the industry.
Employment in oil and gas drilling is down about 5,000 since before the pandemic, and down about 70,000 since the peak in 2014. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Contango and backwardation, by the way, my two favorite business and economic buzzwords. I mean, they just kind of roll right off your tongue, right? Okay, no, they don't. Back in the before times, if you could have looked south from L.A. down over the ports of Long Beach and Los Angeles, you might have seen on any given day at most maybe one container ship having to wait to tie up and unload. This morning at 7 a.m., you'd have seen 26 of those ships full of all the furniture and appliances and gym equipment and building materials that this economy has been devouring during this pandemic. And with consumers set to spend a whole lot more this year, well, that backlog is not likely to let up, as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports.
The kind of backlog of container ships that we're seeing now started around the end of last year, says Kip Lutit, executive director of the Marine Exchange of Southern California.
We jumped from 0 to 1 container ships at anchor to about 35 the 1st of January.
Ships are waiting longer inside the port, too, says Gene Soroka, executive director of the Port of Los Angeles. And fulfillment centers are overloaded.
When a container is waiting at a warehouse, it's now sitting for about 8 days, and that's usually about 3.5 days during pre-pandemic times.
There are two reasons for the backup. First, there's been a surge in global shipping thanks to online shopping. Second, there's COVID. Jonathan Gold follows supply chain policy for the National Retail Federation.
And hopefully as we get additional longshoremen vaccinated, truckers vaccinated, we can add more workers back to the workforce and be able to address some of the ongoing issues that we're seeing.
If the backlogs continue, the cost of shipping will rise, says economist Katie Russ at UC Davis. She says that could be passed on to consumers. But a bigger issue, she says, is whether manufacturers will be able to get the parts and materials they need.
And to the degree that they can't get those, that introduces a whole other type of uncertainty into their production decisions and their hiring decisions.
At the Port of Los Angeles, Executive Director Gene Soroka expects backlogs to continue at least until midsummer. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, there was some good. There was a little bit of bad. There was some ugly. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. President Biden's relief bill could be a done deal by the end of the week. And tucked into that $1.9 trillion package is billions of dollars for small businesses. We are looking this month at micro businesses, let's say less than 20 employees, and how they have been weathering this whole thing. Audrey Hoyt runs and owns the Pioneer Collective. They offer co-working spaces in Seattle and in Tacoma, Washington. She runs it with her husband and a couple of employees. Audrey, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Kai. Great to be here.
Let me ask you the very first question I always ask business people when I get them on the phone. How is business? How goes it?
Well, I will say at this particular moment, it feels pretty good. 2020 was obviously a whirlwind of a year, but I would say just in the last couple of weeks, we're feeling a little bit more optimistic in general and hoping that we can make it through to the other side.
That's great, as are we all. But before we get to the other side, let me take you back to last February, March, when when all of this started happening. I mean, Seattle was hit really early. If we can all remember back then, the virus spiked and it went south in Seattle in a hurry. What happened to you?
Yes. Yeah, so we were about 5 years into our business in February of 2020, and February of 2020 was our best month to date. We had been growing year over year. My husband and I are the sole owners of our business, so, you know, we felt like, okay, we finally, you know, made it. We have a sustainable business, and, you know, we started hearing whispers of what was happening with COVID, and almost overnight, we essentially almost had to shut our business down. So I happened to be pregnant at the time with our third child, and he was born on March 15th. And I would say that date was pretty much that overnight moment. Governor Inslee, we're in Washington State, had mandated the shutdown of restaurants and bars and limited gatherings. And, you know, our revenue was kind of cut in half overnight.
I can't imagine a newborn and all of this.
It kept it exciting.
Yeah, I'm sure it did. So one of the things we're doing in this series is sort of looking beyond small businesses down to the micro business level, which you and your husband are running with just a couple of employees. Do you feel like you are a factor in the conversations that are happening about saving businesses in this economy?
You know, I do. And we have been really grateful to receive both rounds of PPP and some rent relief. So, you know, we are being heard, but everyone else, you know, has a real leg up getting out of this. I worry that all micro businesses are going to have a really challenging time getting out of this. I think it was almost untenable to run a micro business prior to the pandemic. And all of a sudden, you're trying to figure out grant programs and PPP funding. Yeah. You just don't have enough manpower to even operate your business anymore, let alone keep up paying taxes and making sure you're doing everything correctly when you've lost, you know, 2/3 of your customers.
Yeah. So, all right. So now getting to the, you know, we're getting out of this thing. What are you looking at to know that, because I imagine there are still a zillion things keeping you up at night besides the almost now 1-year-old child. But what are you looking at to know that it's going to be okay?
Yeah, well, I would say I'm really reassured seeing that people are realizing they really miss the serendipity and spontaneity of human interaction again. And I know many people have enjoyed the work from home, but my husband and I have been working together for a long time, and the way we work successfully is knowing that we never are in the same place at once. And I think a lot of people are recognizing that. And before the pandemic, you know, we did $37,000 in February alone in meeting room rentals. That was a huge growing part of our business. And I really believe that people want that more than ever when it is safe.
Yeah. Yep. Audrey Hoyt.
At least I hope so.
Yeah, well, me too. Believe you me, me too. And lots of other people as well. Audrey Hoyt, who runs with her husband a company in Seattle, Washington called the Pioneer Collective. Audrey, thanks a lot.
Thank you. I appreciate your time.
Up next, IPO news. Coursera, that's a digital learning company that offers college-level and professional courses. It says it's going to start trading shares publicly. Ticker symbol is going to be COUR, if you want to keep track of that. You know, in a lot of ways, education has been at the front of all the changes in our digital and technological lives this pandemic has brought. And in its filing, Coursera says it had 59% growth in the past year and that it expects that trend to continue. Marketplace's Erica Barris has that story.
Platforms like Coursera are known as MOOCs. That's an acronym for Massive Open Online Courses. Carla Hickman, a researcher with educational consulting group EAB, says when everything went online in 2020, traditional colleges came knocking.
They were turning to other institutions to ask what kind of arrangements could be made, and providers like Coursera were absolutely a first place many institutions turned.
Coursera already had the technology and strategic know-how that colleges needed. Lots of the classes are professional development, everything from machine learning to Korean. Robert Kelchin is a professor of higher education at Seton Hall University. He says institutions like Stanford and Duke do have robust online platforms, but having classes on Coursera is a way to lure people in who might then go on to get a degree.
So that's the incentive for colleges to consider partnering. It's not for the academic content side. It's more for the marketing and promotion side of things.
Coursera now has 77 million users. Even so, University of Florida professor Justin Ortegas says he's skeptical.
I just can't see this being a partnership that's going to continue for years and years to come. I think this is something that was made out of necessity in relationship to the pandemic.
Online courses may be filling a current demand. Ortega says once the pandemic is over, higher ed may not need MOOCs quite as much. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
This pandemic's been a tipping point for a whole lot of things. Education, for sure, as Erica was just saying. Also, though, for a lot of people's careers. Kate Bellino's one of the 10 people we've been following for our series about the American labor force. It's called The United States of Work. And Kate changed her career, inspired in part by the killing of George Floyd and the national reckoning it inspired. She left a job in banking, moved from Colorado to Washington, D.C., and went in search of being able to make a difference. She sent us an update.
I have 233 job applications under my belt, and I'm still going. I think moving out here, I was a little naive. I was like, okay, I'm going to move to DC. I'm going to get involved and make a difference. But it's just been challenging because this city is full of people just like me who are passionate and hungry to make a change. So like, while it's been challenging to kind of separate myself from the crowd, it's also been really humbling and encouraging to be in a space where there's so many like-minded people. My mental health fluctuates week to week, depending on what I heard back or didn't hear back from. I would probably say I've heard back on 20% of the applications I've sent in. A huge chunk I just never hear back on. So it's a little frustrating, but fortunately, I'm a compulsive saver. So I still have a pretty okay financial cushion from when we first moved out here. Now that my partner has a job, the fire under us to get at least one income has dissipated. So that's good. But I still feel like this was the best decision for me. And I know that something's going to stick soon. That's what I keep telling myself to get myself through this.
I bet it's got to be rough. Kate Bellino there from our series, The United States of Work. Coming up.
Industry is certainly going to give you an answer that's going to benefit industry.
Well, always got to consider the source, right? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials added 306 points today, just shy of 1%, closed at 31,802. The NASDAQ down 310 points. Take that, 2.4%, 12,609. The S&P 500 down 20, a little over 0.5%. 3,821. On this International Women's Day, How about we take a look at gender in the workplace? Shall we? The Dutch consulting firm Equileap ranked corporations by looking at gender balance in the boardroom and in the workforce, as well as pay, parental leave, and sexual harassment policies. Topping the list, Norway's biggest bank, DNB ASA, followed by firms in Australia and the UK. France's L'Oreal in fourth place, the US's own General Motors in fifth. One other American corporation made the top 10 in seventh place, Nielsen Holdings. Those people of the ratings game, among other things. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.59%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Justin was talking up at the beginning of the program about port congestion, right? But the trade news of late has been of policy as well as practical application. The United States and the European Commission agreed last week to suspend tariffs on airplanes and food and alcohol. That includes wine and whiskey, by the way. Those tariffs on Chinese imports, though, on something like $375 billion worth of Chinese goods that we import every single year, the Biden administration says it is evaluating them, but for now, those tariffs are staying. So to get a sense of what this looks like on the ground or in the shipping container, as it were, we've gotten Gretchen Blau on the phone. She's a customs brokerage manager at Logistics Plus. They are in Erie, Pennsylvania. And when we talked, I asked her what the Trump-Biden transition has been like for her.
Everyone seemed to think that a magic wand would wave and all the China tariffs would go away when the Trump administration left, but that's not the case. President Biden is looking to study the effect of all of those extra tariffs on American importers because they're the ones paying the tariffs. So no magic wand is out there to wave and send all those tariffs away.
Which sounds to me like uncertainty, which is kind of like what we had the past 4 years in trade policy. Mm-hmm. Are your clients seeing that as well?
Yes. And they keep asking me, well, when are they going away? Right. And I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know. At least this time around, they're planning on spending more than spending less. It still doesn't make for good planning, but at least, you know, they might end up with a nice surprise at the end of it if and when they do go away. So there is that, if you want to look at it in a positive spin.
Sure. Well, let's do that just because. As we look back on 2020, what was the trade and customs brokerage situation? What were you seeing move, and what did you not see that you might have expected to have seen?
Well, the main manufacturers were still importing. We have one client that manufactures cleaning equipment, so they were doing really well. There was absolutely no congestion at the port. Everything was coming in early. Which we never really see. We're talking like a week to two early.
Wow.
Now it's kind of the opposite. Everything's a week to two late.
Which is not good. I mean, if you're trying to get something, I don't care if it's cleaning supplies or you know, fabric for a purse that you make, that's not a good thing.
Right. Working in the supply chain, you go to a store or you try and order something and the person that's working there starts to explain, oh, well, our shipment's been delayed and we can't fix what you have. And you can tell they're used to being yelled at. And, you know, everyone in our business kind of shrugs and said, okay, we get it. We know. And you kind of get the look from the person or the attitude from the person on the phone like, really? Yeah. You're not going to argue with me? I know. You don't have to explain.
I kind of love that. That you sort of can't actually even go about your daily life without thinking about supply chains.
Everything we do is affected by the supply chain. My son's laptop died and I had to send it to Texas last week, and that was the last place in the world I wanted to send it to get fixed.
Yeah, of course.
To be perfectly honest.
Because of the storm. To that port congestion thing, right? Part of that obviously is because the economy is picking up. I imagine you see indicators of economic, you know, gains and growth before those of us who are just, you know, kind of getting by in this economy.
Right, just like we saw the effects of COVID before the rest of the United States. We're seeing a lot of the smaller importers that don't import on a regular basis when the economy is normal, starting to pick up and you know, putting together what's called a consolidated shipment. When they're a smaller importer, we consolidate the shipments in one container to lower the cost of the overall shipments. it's kind of like welcoming old friends back where they weren't doing much over the summer because of the situation. Right. And now we're seeing their goods again, which is a good sign.
Right. Gretchen Blau, she's a customs brokerage manager at Logistics Plus there in Erie, Pennsylvania. Gretchen, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time and your insights.
Thank you.
There are, give or take, 40 nominees for high-level jobs in the Biden administration moving through the Senate confirmation process right at this moment. That's out of about 1,250 who are going to have to be Senate-approved, so it's going to take a while. In all, a president has about 4,000 political appointments to make all through the federal workforce. And once they are all in place, they're going to be joining colleagues who've been through a lot the past 4 years. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer picks it up from there.
President Biden started trying to shore up federal employees' morale even before his inauguration, sending a video to the federal workforce in early January.
And I know this transition was a little more challenging than usual, to say the least. I commend you for your professionalism, your honor, your integrity.
Parts of the workforce Biden inherited from former President Trump were decimated. Max Steyer, head of the Good Government Group Partnership for Public Service, has been keeping track of the brain drain.
In 2019, there were many agencies that had seen upwards of 12% of their workforce go away.
According to partnership data, during the Trump administration, the full-time workforce at the Office of Personnel Management, basically the government's HR department, contracted almost 55%. The Labor Department down almost 12%. Then there's the Agriculture Department.
The research organizations at the Department of Agriculture were moved with a terrible process to the Midwest, and upwards of three-quarters of the employees didn't go.
Andrew Crane Droche was an economist at one of the two research arms ordered to relocate to Missouri. He refused and quit. He was working on climate change models at the Agriculture Department. Crane Droche says that's exactly the kind of analysis the Biden administration will need to implement its sweeping plans to combat global warming.
Without in-house experts, you're left asking industry, and industry is certainly going to give you an answer that's going to benefit industry.
Biden's plans to monitor industrial workplaces are also affected by gaping personnel holes. Biden issued an executive order the day after he was inaugurated, requiring employers to protect their workers from COVID. But OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, doesn't have enough workplace inspectors to enforce that. Chris Liu is a former deputy labor secretary in the Obama administration who helped with the Biden transition. He says the Trump administration was slow to replace inspectors who quit, leaving OSHA with the lowest number of inspectors since the 1970s.
As people left, jobs weren't backfilled. So, you know, the lack of inspectors makes it hard to get people out to the places they need to be.
Liu says there's also a lack of top diplomats at the State Department. Vacancies at the Department of Health and Human Services will complicate Biden's plans to shore up the Affordable Care Act. And personnel is policy, says Christina Kinane, who teaches political science at Yale. The new administration will have to scale up staffing to reach its goals. Kinane says Biden does have one big advantage over other incoming presidents, a huge pool of people who are ready to go.
He is uniquely positioned to have a set of appointees who served in the Obama administration just 4 years ago.
Another way to staff up, allow federal employees to work from home permanently. Andrew Crane Droche, the economist who left the Agriculture Department, says he has no plans to go back, but the chance to work remotely would be a great recruiting perk. I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today. As I speak these words, I'm looking at my phone at the very first tweet that Twitter co-founder Jack Dorsey sent. March 21st, 2006. Just setting up my Twitter, he wrote. It's right there on my phone, available for me to read. Free. But if you want to own that tweet as a non-fungible token, we talked about these the other day. Non-fungible, one of a kind, right? That's the deal. As an investment of that type? Well, that'll cost you $2.5 million. Dorsey's auctioning it off as an NFT, $2.5 million,
or free on your phone. You decide. All right, we got to go, but here's your Monday moment of economic context. Aviation division comes as the CDC's new guidelines for people who are fully vaccinated recommend they still refrain from traveling. It's an oldie, but a goodie. Yesterday, almost 1.3 million people passed through TSA checkpoints. 2 years ago yesterday, because a year ago things were already slowing down. Yesterday in 2019, 2.1 million. Andy Corbin, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Minju Park do daily production for us. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.